Hello and thank you very much indeed for joining me on this edition of the Nutra Ingredients Asia Nutra Champion podcast, where I am in Singapore and very pleased to say I've been joined by Professor Jaya Henry from the Clinical Nutrition Research Centre. Good to see you as always, Jaya.
Good to see you too, Gary. Always a pleasure to have you here on the home territory.
Thank you very much indeed. Now, the whole kind of purpose of our podcast is to look at those people who've really been at the driving force of nutrition research here in Asia Pacific. So let's start in the here and now. You're heading up the Clinical Nutrition Research Centre here in Singapore, a relatively new institution, but one that's quickly made its mark, I think, in the industry. Tell us about how this all came about and how you came here in Singapore to set up this organization.
So I came to Singapore in the summer of 2011, and it took us 2.5 years to set up the center. And in January of 2014, we launched the center as you see it today. So we are a little over 5 and a bit years old, and during the 5 and a bit years old, we have sort of exponentially grown, and I think we are really being punching way above our weight.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, looking in from the outside, what probably sets the Clinical Nutrition Research Centre apart from perhaps some of the others is its very local and regional focus and its commitment to finding nutritional solutions for the local population and the challenges that they find here in Asia.
Absolutely, I think to be fair, the science of nutrition had its major growth in Europe and North America.
Yeah.
It's a discipline that's predicated those regions. But in the recent times, we have realized that the way in which Asians metabolize and respond to food is quite different to Caucasians. Now, that realization is no mystery as a recent one, because research in Asia amongst Asians has been quite limited. So therefore, the stroke of luck is that Singapore represents large proportion of 3 major ethnicities of the world, the Chinese, Indians and Malays, that collectively are about 3.6 billion people. But with one single stop, you have access to these 3 ethnic groups. So we can do a clinical trial on Caucasians, the 3 different ethnic groups, and that separates us from any other global competitor, because we have under one roof the wherewithal to do these experiments to show what the differences are. And more importantly, every single multinational wants to market and penetrate the Asian market, but the Asian companies that want to do business are being demanded by the Asian governments, I want local Asian data. So it's a kind of a, we are sitting in a sweet spot. And the sweet spot is a combination of purpose and vision, but also serendipity.
Absolutely, and you make a very interesting point there about the MNCs and the local companies, because your growth has almost gone hand in hand with the growth of the food ingredients and the nutritional ingredients sector here in Singapore. How important has it been that you've engaged with industry, collaborated with industry, so it's far more than just the research, but we're actually seeing, I guess, definitive outcomes when it comes to product development and then consumer benefit?
Absolutely. We have, from the word go, been intimately involved with industry, because without industry partnership, actually, it's actually a bread without butter. Because we need to understand that at the heart of industry is also good science. And the good science is what we have a marriage of convenience, because when we do a study with industry, right from the ground base upwards, we interact and discourse with their counterpart scientists, we build up a proposal together. And so the research paradigm is not a research output on its own that's going to sit as a paper in somebody's library, but has got application. So our success has been to do good research that you can apply not the day after, but right now.
Yes, indeed, indeed. And you know, there's some very well documented health challenges faced in this region, be it obesity, be it diabetes. When you look back over the last 4 or 5 years, is there perhaps 1 or 2 pieces of work that to your mind really stand out as having the potential to assist with some of those issues?
Yes, so our focus has been quite deliberately on 2 broad areas, trying to understand how food can be the new medicine for diabetic management and pre-diabetic management, and of course for obesity and weight regulation. Let me come to the first issue of diabetes. I mean, It is a startling statistics that of the 400 odd million type 2 diabetics in the world, 200 odd million, that's 50%, live in Asia. And the double irony is that for every diagnosed diabetic, there are three undiagnosed pre-diabetics. Yeah. So the numbers in Asia are astronomical. And to have a tablet of pharmacological intervention in these populations is nearly impossible. And so the question is that, can we look at diet that you and I consume on a daily basis be an addendum to manage and treat diabetes? But we can't use the adage, my grandmother did this, I'm going to, because we are now living in an era of evidence-based science. So we provide the evidence and the consumer can recognize that it's evidence-based. But most of all, the industry can then take that ball and run with it, because now it is not based on anecdote, but on facts.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot more research, a lot more investment, a lot more developments here in Singapore when it comes to nutrition. I don't think anyone sees any sign of that slowing, and we very much look forward to hearing more about that in the future. But let's go, if we can, right the way back to the beginning. You started your career in London.
Yes.
What was it that first piqued your interest in food science and nutrition, and I guess convinced you to embark on this career path?
Very interesting. I was born and grew up in Ceylon, now known as Sri Lanka. Yeah. And my dad was a biologist, and we went regularly to the forest because we were both keen on wildlife and bird watching, ornithology. And from the age of 5 or 6, my parents took us to the jungle of Ceylon. And during that period, my dad being a sort of a very calm, collected academic, used to always make anecdotal observation, like saying, look at that fruit, guava, it's high in vitamin C. Now imagine a 6-year-old hearing these kind of things, but it stuck in my brain. Then, as luck would have it, I became an obsessional Boy Scout, and I had to camp out in the jungle with my troop, and we had to learn to cook. And I then became quite deeply interested in cooking, and I still remember the kind of a eureka moment where you boiled an egg and a liquid became a solid, and I said to myself, what's the chemistry? So I think I had a juxtaposition of my parental inputs opening my eyes to food in the forest, and my own Boy Scout experience of real hands-on cooking, that I realized that I had to do something on food. But growing up in Ceylon during the period of the late 60s, early 70s, there was not a single university at that time that could do a degree in food technology.
Yes.
So my parents shipped me off to Bombay to do a degree in food technology. And I came back home with my first degree in Bombay, which happened to be a wonderful experience. And I said to myself, at the time in Bombay, my professor, an Indian professor who had just come back from MIT in Boston, said, you can't stay with the first degree, you've got to do a master's. So I went back home and I applied to two places to do a higher degree. First was to an American university to do a master's in food technology.
Yeah.
And a master's at the London School of Top Medicine in nutrition. So when I came back home, I asked my dad, what should I do? And my dad was, without batting an eyelid, he says, son, you mustn't have a chocolate cake and have chocolate icing, meaning don't do a master's in food technology,
yes,
but do something else. And that was the best piece of advice that he gave me, because then I had two strings to my bow, food technology and nutrition, which became to me the DNA of my life, because actually I combine much of what I do that straddles between food technology and nutrition in a way that I'm so proud of and very happy.
Absolutely, and that move though, I guess, going from being in Sri Lanka and doing your studies
Absolutely.
In India to finding yourself in the middle of London, doing something slightly different academic-wise as
exactly.
well. How was that? Must have been a bit of a shock when you first arrived.
Yes, but the truth be told, the London School of Tropical Medicine, as the term implies, had almost all of its work in developing countries.
Yes.
So it was set up during the time of the colonial period, where they had to treat the people coming back from these large tracts of the tropics. So it was actually like a duck taking the water, because all of the work that we initially did in the London School of Tropical Medicine was things that afflicted people like vitamin deficiency, protein deficiency, iron deficiency, that were all related to what's happening in the tropics. So although I was living in the West, the problems and issues that we confronted were very much close to my heart living and working in Sri Lanka. So it's just a kind of a revelation and an opening of a road to Damascus, because the study patterns in Britain were outstanding. Mm-hmm. And I think I pay great tribute to my own professor, who was a wonderful man, who really nurtured us and was a man of great passion. And I still have tears in my eyes when I think of him, because they were great guys, great sort of visionaries, and that was a wonderful period of
my life. Who was this chair? Who was that inspiration?
The name of the person is Professor John Waterlow. Mm-hmm. He was one of the biggest nutritionists in the world, I would say, and certainly in the United Kingdom. And he had set up in his lifetime a tropical metabolic research unit in Jamaica. He did all the work on how to treat malnourished children. So he was a hands-on clinician, medical doctor, but he also had great empathy for people from all parts of the world. And I think one of my most memorable moments was the kind of international parties that he used to throw. He was a very sort of flamboyant man, but it was wonderful. I got great fond memories.
Wonderful, wonderful. And then after your time in London, and I think where, you know, perhaps maybe if I can say you kind of really started to make your mark in a big way was in Oxford.
Yes.
At the Functional Food Centre. And I think that's probably also where the wider connections to business and industry came Absolutely. Along. And it's certainly where, you know, I first became aware of your work. Tell me how all that came about.
So when I came to Oxford, there was only Oxford Brookes University that had any particular broad interest in food and nutrition. Yeah. And they played an important role in my life, because during my time at Oxford Brookes, they gave me incredible free rein to do the kind of research that we did, and most of all the facilities and the funding. And so that was a very important period. We were at the heart of many of the challenges. I then had the great fortune to become the first board member of the UK Food Tender Agency in the 2000s, and that sort of allowed me to access and open up different avenues of research. And the chairman of the first committee was Sir John Krebs, the son of the Nobel Prize winner Hans Krebs. So that opened up your eyes to a variety of things. How do you manage risk? You know, that was the time when we had the BAC crisis. Yeah. So we had 12-member panel discussing science, which was at the what we call the white heat of technology. What do you do when people were affected by potentially BSC? What kind of technology do we need to use to cull them? What is the risk-benefit analysis? How do you use science to inform and influence politicians? And that is a wonderful period that you also learned that sometimes science may need to be placed in the second altar, because there are other issues that may be more important.
Yes. And I think I wanted to touch on your involvement. You've been involved in many advisory panels and government boards over the last couple of decades. And I think, you know, perhaps there's a temptation amongst some people to think these are just talking shops, you know, don't actually ever lead to any kind of concrete outcomes. When you look back on that time, are there certain projects that you were involved in where you're especially proud because of either, you know, perhaps the public health benefit that it contributed to?
So let's look at the Food Standard Agency. It was ahead of its curve. Mm. 2000, where the state government of Great Britain was saying, I'm going to have an autonomous body that adjudicates on the health and safety and the welfare of the food supply that is independent to the gatekeeper and the poacher. And that's unique. And now that's been emulated by the EFSA and even Singapore and many countries. So you have to say the FSA was a global leader. And that's the amazing thing about Britain always being ahead of the curve in many of these areas. So I was very proud to be a part of that great vision and to say, how do we actually manage food production, food delivery, food safety? And also within that, although FSA's initial mandate was not to look at nutrition, it soon became apparent that nutrition had to be enveloped like icing into a cake, because without that you really couldn't talk about food safety and food security.
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the other challenges, and I think it's probably one that you've overcome very easily when it comes to the world of science and nutrition, it's one thing to undertake the work, it's one thing to do the studies, it's a very different thing to be able to communicate about them. I just wonder, in your mind, how you feel, even now today, whether academia as a whole, when it comes to science and nutrition research, is effectively able to communicate what it's doing well enough.
So I think the historical anecdote of a academic who's good is a kind of a bald-headed, bubbling, you know, boffin. And I think those days are gone, because communication is the root of access to knowledge. And with all this sort of media that we have, you know, Facebook, Twitter, it is very media sensitive. Now, I don't think you can be an effective communicator if you don't have any modest skill sets of translating complex issues into simplified knowledge that Joe Block down the road can understand. It's not easy, but it could be trained. And I don't think it's something that's unique to certain paper, but I also think that going forward, communication should be a part of the imperative of training scientists of tomorrow, because you can't afford to be a scientist who lives in an ivory tower and who's shy to talk and is not prepared to take the leap of faith of communication.
Yeah, okay, in that case, Jay, I'm gonna put you on the spot. So turning complicated information into something easily understandable. We'll stay at your time at Oxford. If you think back to all of the work and the research you undertook at Oxford, what's the one paper, I think you've published over 200 in your career, what's the one paper that stays in your mind, and what's the headline finding?
So the headline finding that we rather embarrassingly developed what's called a Henry equation, which actually allows you to predict your basal metabolic rate just by knowing your body weight. Now, the basal metabolic rate is the largest component of your energy requirement. So if I know your body weight, I can predict your basal metabolic rate, which allows you to predict how much of energy you need to eat per day. So it's of very importance, because if you're trying to formulate meals in an hospital, you want to feed refugees in a refugee camp, if you want to know how much I feed my granddad who's frail, how much I need to feed my parents. So it's, to me, a very important culmination of my energy work, and I think I'm quite proud of it being something that we did whilst I was in UK.
Absolutely. Okay, yeah. You passed the test with flying colours, don't worry. So yeah. Then let's come right back to the present then. So after Oxford, you came over here to Singapore, and we've mentioned some of the very specific challenges that are faced in the region. And I think Singapore is clearly leading the way in this work. But how important is it that the work you're doing here also brings in the neighbouring countries in Southeast Asia to help them on their journey to tackling these problems as well?
Very, very important. In fact, we are particularly sensitive to that. In fact, just last week we ran for the first time the beginning of what we call an ASEAN network of scientists in food and nutrition in this region. I think we have a social global responsibility to be able to network and bind people in this region. And I started my talk with this launch of the ASEAN network by giving the example of the European Union. In the European Union, where we spend most of our time, there is a fantastic network of nutritional scientists in 27 countries, or should I say 26 soon, where we could move easily at every level as a postdoc, a pre-doc, a junior scientist, and a senior scientist. And ironically, we don't have such a fora in the ASEAN region, just in 10. So we have set up this network, which with time will grow. We are at the moment Malaysia and Singapore. We will have Thailand next year, and slowly move in multiples to include all of them. Because I think South-South dialogue is going to be as important as North-South dialogue. Yeah. So we are very good at North-South dialogue, and that will remain as a part of our fulcrum of activity. But moving forward, I think there is a lot to be learned from each other. But most of all, also for me, my professor John Wattlow, late Lord, would always say, "Yeah, it's not what you know that matters, but also who you know." And I think he's 110% right.
Yes, indeed. And then as we kind of look to the future, there's going to be a lot more projects here in Singapore, and obviously a lot more research to be undertaken. It's a very competitive landscape, especially when it comes to undergraduates, postgraduates. How do you encourage the younger generation to embark on this career in food and nutrition when there's so many other avenues and potential career paths for them?
Very good. So I use a very simple message, somewhat biblical. I say those that do food and nutrition are God's chosen people, because no other discipline barring medicine can touch human lives as food and nutrition. And I rest my case.
And I think that's where we have to rest the case for the entire interview, Jay, because I don't think we're going to be able to top that. Thank you very much
indeed
for your time.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you. Great talking to you, as always, Gary.